WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Writer V.S. Naipaul writes from the perspective of someone who's never felt completely at home in his country. His parents were Indian Hindus who had emigrated to Trinidad. Growing up in multiracial Trinidad as a member of the Indian community, Naipaul says he always knew how important it was not to fall into non-entity. Naipaul left Trinidad in 1950 to attend Oxford and has lived in London ever since. But he's traveled around the world to Africa, the Caribbean, and India, writing fiction and nonfiction set in post-colonial countries. Elizabeth Hardwick described his vision as fixed upon the brutal collision of cultures, the anguish of whole countries and peoples unable to cope. In a review of A Bend in the River, a novel set in Africa, John Updike wrote, Naipaul writes of an Africa of withering colonial vestiges, terrifyingly murky politics, defeated pretensions, omnivorous rot, and the implacable undermining of all that would sustain reason and safety. Rage is perhaps the deepest and darkest fact Naipaul has to report about the Third World. Naipaul's nonfiction books include Among the Believers, An Islamic Journey, which is based on his travels through Iran. His novels include A House for Mr. Biswas and Guerrillas. His latest book, A Turn in the South, is a travel book about the southern United States. I asked him why he wanted to write about the American South.
It had never occurred to me to write about the American South. I suppose because one had spent so much time in... When one came to America, one went to the, you know, New York and... Then Connecticut. There was a little foray into California at one time. I never thought of the South, and I suppose the other reason for that was that the South's racial reputation was so dreadful when I was a child that one really put it out of one's mind altogether. But then I was asked by the New York Review of Books to go to Dallas for the Republican Convention in 1984, and I was, first of all, terribly excited by the great heat of Dallas in August. Heat contrasted with the excellent central air conditioning of the hotels and the convention halls. So one always had this physical excitement of moving from pleasant environment to something immensely hot, stimulating, of dark shadows. I like that. And then I saw in the hall itself the flags of the state laid out, I suppose, in alphabetical order. And I began to recognize then that some of the older states were British colonies, as much as the colony I had grown up in. And that since my colony was also a slave colony, that there was an awful lot in common, and I was amazed that I had never thought of going to the American South to see what I could pick up and, you know, to see the similarities, because I've always traveled about the world to look at places with which I am connected according to my background, because I was born in Trinidad of Asian immigrant family, so naturally I've been interested in India. England, of course, I've, you know, been living in because it was the language I spoke to and we were a British colony. And Africa I went to have a look at, and other colonial territories like Argentina I also went to look at. And then it was such a revelation to me that here was a big gap. I should go. Well, that was why I went.
What was your strategy when you got to the South to figure out who to talk to and where to go?
I moved by instinct. And this book is written in a slightly different way from other books of similar nature, which I've done, which have been travel books and books of exploration. I figured that the more complicated a history, the more tormented the past, the easier it would be to understand it in human terms. If one could get someone's story, for example, and if one could extract the full meaning from a human personal account, a lot would be delivered, and one would get this in this direct way rather than the tempting analysis, which really it's not something I could have gone to do, because you could spend a lifetime and write about the South. I didn't want that. I wanted to approach it as a novelist, and I thought that through the human stories you could pick up the themes and motifs of the place. You could get an idea of the history, you could get an idea of the stresses, and that was the way I worked. I did it through the people I met. At the beginning, one was scattered, one just picked people up and people who talked to one, and then in their stories, then one got all the various strands one could follow up later. One got the idea of the importance of religion, one got the idea of the depth of the history, and one got the idea of the Southern defeat. And, of course, inevitably, the racial tensions. And as one travelled along then, one explored different things in different places, always so one looked for different people. It's an instinctive, intuitive exercise. And, in fact, it's perhaps very hard to describe fully, but it is the talent, that is the writer's talent, which has been developed over a long time. I don't suppose it would have been easy for me to do when I was just starting.
One of the people who you spoke to was a self-described redneck, and he interested you a lot. And in a way, I think this is the passage that you've come under the most criticism for, because this is someone who spun stories about what redneck culture was like.
Yes.
But kind of leaving out a lot of the more unsavory parts.
Yes.
Like not really directly expressing some of the racism that goes along with that. Go ahead.
No. I think I've won a lot of, caused a lot of delight, really, the bit about the redneck bit. It's wrong, you know, for people to expect writers to write the books that they, the reader, wants to write. A writer has to write his own book. And here, you see, you already know about the racism of the redneck. Why do you want me to write a book about the racism of the redneck? Isn't that taking coal to Newcastle, writing a book you've already read? A writer has to do new things. Really, if I had to write a book which had already been written by lots of other people, the pen would fall from my hand. And I thought that in the South, especially, everyone knows the motifs of the civilization. Everyone knows the history and all the racial tensions. I don't think you have to go rubbing it in all the time. And I think the fact that the rednecks are racist is also said there. But that wasn't enough. They're much more interesting than just being racist. They are people. They have their own codes. They have their own loyalties. They have their own way of living. And I wanted to have a look at that as well. That was presented to me, and that had to be explored. I couldn't blind myself to it and keep on correcting it. Nor could I talk to people and then go away and then, in the privacy of my writing, cut them down to size when I didn't do that in my first personal encounters with them. No, I couldn't do that. I would like in my writing to remain loyal to the way I talk to people. And if they were taking me in and talking to me about things and I didn't fight with them, I wasn't going to fight with them later.
Now, you talk about not writing the book that everybody could have already written.
Exactly. People like old books, you know. That's the trouble. We all read. I know, I've done it myself. You read a book, you turn the pages, you're looking for the book you think should be there.
Well, what really interested me, you saw a lot of Elvis Presley fanatics, and you went to the Grand Ole Opry, and you were really surprised at the hold that singers and musicians have over Americans, and I just take that so for granted. It was really interesting to read somebody who was so surprised by it and trying to come up with an explanation for it.
Yes, well, look, that now, this is where I must confess the deficiency, because, you see, I'm not musical. So then I understood that although I wasn't musical, I would have to do something about it with that deficiency, although I didn't know about music, you know. And there it is, as someone said to me in Nashville, it is white soul music. And so I was able to talk to some writers of it and understand the great art that goes into it. Although it's formula writing, isn't it? And the poverty out of which it came out, the melancholy, the nostalgia, and the kind of sentimentality. Now it's extraordinary, isn't it? That sentimentality of people you consider rough, such sentimental people. So that was interesting to me.
My guest is writer V.S. Naipaul, and his new book is called A Turn in the South. You've made a profession, in a way, of going to other places and writing about them in nonfiction. You've also, of course, written many novels. Is this in part because you felt like an outsider wherever you've lived?
That's too romantic.
Okay.
That's too romantic. Uh-huh. That's too romantic. No, it's a very practical matter. If you come from a small and limited background, and you are a writer, you train to be a writer, you've dedicated your life to being a writer, that little background quickly exhausts itself so far as material goes.
Translated, how many novels could you write about Trinidad?
You can't do very many, you see. You can't write, let's suppose you want to write books about crickets, you know, or ants.
Yeah.
Ants are very old, but you can't do a lot about ants. You can perhaps write about the rights of the ants, and that'd be one good book. Then perhaps you can do a fantasy book about an ant who wants to break away, but then can't survive alone and goes back to living with the rest of the community. But I think that would be or the ant repelling an invader. That would be the limit of what you could do with, this is a frivolous way of talking about the limitations of small societies, for fiction. But yet the talent and the wish to write is there, and so one wanted to look at the bigger world. One shouldn't deny oneself the large world. If you grow up in a small place, you dream of the large world. In America, many people leave their small places to come to the big cities. And so that has been the drive as well, that it's very hard to write about, first of all, small places, and then it is very hard to write novels about fractured experience. I left Trinidad when I was 18 and been knocking around the world for 38 years. The novel flourishes best if one is writing about fixed societies with recognized codes. To write novels about mixed up worlds is not so easy. You do one, you can do two. You can't do a series. You have to find ways of expressing your interest in the world. And my way has been this looking at other places.
You grew up in Trinidad, as you've said, and your parents were Indian. They were Hindu. What brought them to Trinidad?
They went there to work in the plantations after the abolition of slavery. Slavery was abolished in the British Empire about 1834, and the plantations went to rack and ruin, as the planters said. And sometime in the middle of the 19th century, this great social and human engineering that the British Empire got up to, people from India were sent out as indentured servants, and that's my origin. My origin is that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've said that you don't think of yourself as a believer. Talking about religion here. Did you grow up as a believer?
Never. I was born without it. Born without it.
I guess it surprises me to hear that. Maybe I'm just thinking stereotyped, but I would just assume that Indian parents of Hindu descent would bring you up in a pretty religious atmosphere.
In a religious way.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was just born without it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You came across, and this goes back many years, but you came across a very interesting story about your father that you didn't know until years after the fact.
Yes.
And the story I'm thinking of here is, this is a headline in a newspaper article, and your father was a journalist in Trinidad. And the headline was about a journalist who made a goat sacrifice to the goddess Kali.
Yes.
Would you tell that story?
I wonder if I can reconstruct it, really. It's a terrible story. My father was a very young man and writing really quite nicely, considering he more or less self-educated. And he did something about, something critical about Hindu or Indian farmers in central Trinidad who were not vaccinating their cattle against some kind of disease and were instead doing superstitious rites. And this terribly offended some local people. And my father was threatened with death. Now, in another world, or in a braver, a fictional world, the reporter would say, rubbish, I'm not going to perform any rites to Kali. But if you're living in the country and you're threatened with death, then you do buckle, you know. And the poor man did perform the rites to Kali, and I think it damaged him ever after.
How so?
I think he was psychologically damaged by it, because it's a deep, deep humiliation, isn't it? To make a man go through rites he doesn't believe in.
Is that why you think he never told you about it?
He never told me about it, no. He never told me about it. And I discovered the story purely by accident, because someone from the New York Times had spoken to me in 1970, and when he was writing up his story, he sent me this clipping from an American paper, which is the first time our name was mentioned in New York, I think, 1934, thereabouts, where my father had done this goat sacrifice to the goddess Kali. And I had to say I didn't know. And then I went and looked at the old papers in 1972, and there was this terrible story. Yes.
And what effect has the story had on you?
Well, none on me, really. You know, I think about my father rather than this. It has no effect on me. It hasn't, you know... Does it made me very brave and things like that?
No, or is it an example of the kind of thing you wanted to get away from when you left Trinidad?
Oh, no, it isn't Trinidad. That is universal. Oh, that's universal, this thing to make people recant. Oh, that's universal.
Well, do you see any connection between that and between the Ayatollah's death sentence of Salman Rushdie?
I think there might be something like that, but there is no connection. There is no connection. It's just that writers can be. You see, we are as strong as our societies permit us to be. If our societies don't give us enough protection, then we have to be as weak as our societies compel us to be. If you're Galileo, you have to say, yes, all right, the world doesn't move. And then as you walk away, you just mutter under your breath, but it still does, though, but that's all you can do. You're as strong as your institutions. That's all.
I'm just thinking about the comment that you just made, that a writer is as strong as the society that they live in.
Yes.
And I wonder if you think that a lot of writers are afraid to speak out now about Salman Rushdie.
I don't know about that. Okay. But I'd like to say that probably, in fact, when societies become awfully corrupt, mm-hmm. The writing becomes corrupt inevitably. If you're in Russia, you have to find ways of writing. If you are in, shall we say, Latin America, you have to find ways of not being realistic, ways of not analyzing your society, and some people find different ways of doing it, and there's a whole South American school of fantasy, which is really a way of not offending the authorities.
Well, very recently, Nigerian writer Wole Soyinka spoke out against the Ayatollah. He called him a sick and dangerous man who has long forgotten the fundamental tenets of Islam.
Yes.
I was wondering what you felt it was in your power to do as a writer, to say something or not say something about the current crisis.
I wouldn't say anything, really. Mm-hmm. I have nothing. I wouldn't say anything about it, really. I just hope that, you know, it can be put right in some ways. This is a religious dispute. It's just made rather difficult because it's being conducted in a foreign country. It's an internal dispute about the Mohammedan religion. It's nothing to do with other people.
Well, someone's life has been threatened, though.
Yes, but I mean the dispute itself, the nature of the dispute. It's a theological dispute. It's a theological dispute.
You don't see it as a freedom of speech dispute as
no,
well?
No, I don't really. No, I think that's something else, really. That's something else, which has been unfortunately dragged into it. If this dispute was being conducted in Algeria, as it probably can be now, I mean, it would be quite different.
Okay, so you don't think that there are freedom of speech issues at stake?
Not really, not in that way. I think the idea of sensitive freedom of speech is as I said, it's just an accident, really. It's accidental in this thing.
Okay. Let's move on and talk a little bit more about your life. We were talking about living in Trinidad. You left when you were a teenager, went to Oxford University. Why did you want to go to England? I realize you got a scholarship there, so obviously that got you to England. But after you'd finished studying at Oxford, you stayed on in London. And it's interesting to me because that's the colonizer. You grew up in a colonized country.
Yes.
Why did you want to stay in England?
I want you to put yourself a little bit in my shoes. Where would you think I should have gone?
Oh, I have no suggestion, and I didn't mean that as a criticism at all, but...
No, the world was quite different in 1954 from the way the world is today. And, of course, if you want to be a writer, you have to be in a place where books are printed and magazines are printed and there are radio services and books are reviewed. You can't go to a place where books are not printed and not reviewed. I mean, books are physical objects. They're produced and they're sold and they're marketed and they're reviewed and they're libraries, you know. You can't just be a writer in a vacuum.
Did you feel that you were treated as a colonial in England when you arrived?
I think the words, yes, one was a colonial. One wasn't treated as, one was a colonial.
Mm-hmm.
One was a colonial. Yes, one was a colonial.
So how did that affect your writing and your ability to get published and the interest in readers reading you?
Very hard, because there was no interest. There's no interest. It was very, very hard to get started. One's early books had a bit of a struggle. It was a long, long time before I could get my books published in America, you know, because there was no interest in writing from people like me.
You once wrote, "I couldn't be a writer in the same way as English or French writers of my age, because to be a colonial was to be spared knowledge." How did you compensate for that, if that's how you felt?
By that I mean that if you're an English writer or French writer, there's a mass of literature around you, and you were in any case writing to be more or less read by people like yourself. If you were a colonial writer, there wasn't such a mass around you. And the idea of the colonial experience was something you had to arrive at and work towards. You know, you have to work towards the truth, because the literature you had read was, as it were, the literature of whole societies. Do you understand that little point? Do you understand that point?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you understand that point?
I think so. Did you want to elaborate on it more?
No, if we go on like this, I'll start rewriting all the books. we must just pick out what is, pick out a few things here and there.
In your book, The Overcrowded Barracoon, you say that you wonder why no one has done a study on the reasons for the popularity of books about racial discrimination. What made you wonder
about
that?
Did I say that?
Yes, you did.
Can you quote the thing for me? I've written so much over 30 years. I like things in context, you know.
Do you want me to quote that again?
Please, again. Please give me the context. So then otherwise it comes out at me, and I've been writing for such a long time.
No, I understand. That you wondered why no one has done a study on the reasons for the popularity of books about racial discrimination.
Ah, yes, yes, yes. I think I don't know what you're referring to, but I think it appeals to a kind of sadistic element in some people, and I find a lot of the writing about racial discrimination a little distasteful for that reason.
But by sadistic, you mean people are secretly identifying with the oppressor?
Yes, yes, and yes. It's a story of degradation that appeals to people. I think there's a little bit of that in it, yes. I think that might have been the prompting for that observation.
Well, you went on to say that for you it's never been easier to write a simple book about discrimination because, as an Indian, the oppressor was always changing.
Yes, how could you do it? Because... the ideas now are getting getting so dense. You'll see why one can't write a book about discrimination. To say that one is suffering from racial discrimination as an Indian or an Asiatic, you have to say then we are dealing with, shall we say, the British. Now, if you write that, you leave out, first of all, the failings of your own culture, which have exposed you to conquest. And they are very, very serious failings. Not to look at the internal failings of the culture would be a dereliction. You're looking at the failings of Indian family life, which are full of cruelties. Not to look at that would be wrong. if you were talking about discrimination and you just confine it to the British and you don't look at the discriminations in multiracial societies where every race has one set of rules and, you know, they don't get along quite well with every other race, that is to greatly simplify it. And I think the subject is not important, really. I really don't think so in today's world. And I tell you why I don't think so. I think all these principles about racial justice and everything else have been conceded a long time ago now. And to talk about them as though they still have to be won is really to be sitting on a very, very, you know, to be batting on a very easy wicket.
Well, I know what you mean, but on the other hand, the fact that they've been conceded in many areas doesn't mean that they're actually being practiced.
No, I said conceded. The principles have been conceded.
Right, but if the principles have been conceded, it doesn't mean that racism isn't
exactly.
still being practiced
in spite of
it.
I'm not going to fight. That's what you see, I speak precisely. Mm-hmm. I did said the principles have been conceded. Mm-hmm. And I cannot then go around with a book ticking off where the places where the principles have been conceded but they're not practiced. That's for somebody else to do, you know. Mm-hmm. I mustn't keep on doing the things you want me to do, you know.
What are you working on now? Are you working on...
I'm just looking around and trying to enjoy meeting people.
Do you get nervous during that process when you're looking around?
No. No, it's fun. I love looking around. I'm very stimulated when I'm looking around.
And you're always confident you'll come up with the subject
No, I'm not confident at all. No, a lot of my time is spent in anxiety.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
All right.